You know, with the exciting talk of NEMA coming on the public lecture, and we have NEMA again tomorrow talking about the standard model landscape at 11 a.m. in here. And then just more talks tomorrow. We have Jimmy Ryan and two in the quantum gravity talk, who's a just arrived postdoc. And then, I don't know what he's acting as team, but in the 4 o'clock quantum gravity foundation seminar, more discussion about landscapes. So it's very, very nice to have Brian Cole here. As you know, we try to keep up with what's going on in experiment, and the last year or 2 years, there's been a lot of excitement among theorists in QCD and string theorists about heavy ion physics, with the exciting possibility of understanding at least some aspects of heavy ion physics through ADS CFT. And so we thought it would be good to have an expert on the real physics, on the real phenomenon of heavy ion physics here. Brian is a professor at Columbia University. Before that, he did both of his degrees at MIT. He is very involved in the RIT collaboration and also involved in aspects of heavy ion physics at the LHC. And he's here all to visit us.
Thank you. Is it possible to
Just the first one, there we go.
Excellent. All right, thank you very much. So I will be telling you about the experimental program at RIT and the to the LHC. That's only about a year and a half away, and by the end of my talk, I hope you get a sense of some of the excitement that those of us in the field feel at the possibility of carrying on the program from RIC to the LHC. I am an experimentalist. I work on the Phoenix experiment at RIC. I won't be spending really any time talking about experimental details, so I'll spare you that. But this is at least one picture of an experiment that you get to see. This is a schematic of the ATLAS detector at the LHC, primarily built to study PP collisions, but the Large Hadron Collider will also collide lead nuclei at 5.5 TeV. And that will be an important part of that program, and one of my jobs is to develop a heavy ion program for ATLAS. This is maybe one other experimental detail. It's an event display picture from one of the detectors at RIC, which measures many particles in the final state. It covers a large part of the acceptance for the collision, in this case, of two gold ions at 200 GeV per nucleon, colliding nucleon pair in the center of mass. Now, what you see here are essentially connected points measured by the detector, showing the trajectories of particles coming out of the collision. They're curved because the particles are being bent in a magnetic field. And a star with this particular detector sees about 2,000 particles per event. Okay. Now, you know, somebody who didn't know anything about this field would probably look at this picture and say it's nice and pretty, but why would you ever consider doing this? Okay, and so that's one of the things I hope you come away from my colloquium understanding is that this physics is complicated, but the complexity is actually part of the point. And the hope is that by going to very complicated systems that exhibit more collective and thermodynamic behavior, we can actually learn something about one of the fundamental interactions, QCD, and a completely different regime from where it's normally studied in high energy experiments. So to just set the scale, and we start with something completely simple, right? This picture that we use to instruct some of our most beginning students about physics, maybe even high school students, teaching them about the four fundamental interactions. I show this because if you think about all the effort that is expended in physics, studying matter, let's say condensed matter, in the laboratory, it's a huge part of the field of physics. Tremendous, you know, amount of work goes into it. There's a lot of very exciting physics. And yet, that big branch of physics is entirely focused on matter that is dominated by the physics here. Okay? And a very interesting question to ask, what would happen if you change the interaction so that it was non-abelian? And the only way that we can easily do that in the laboratory is with the strong interaction, But the fact is, we can do that in the laboratory, and we can ask experimentally questions like, how is matter that interacts through an SU3 interaction different from electromagnetic interactions? And we're starting to be able to answer those kinds of questions. Now, to give you a different sort of view of the big picture, we have a fundamental theory of the strong interactions. This is a QCD Lagrangian that's been known now for since before I was an undergraduate student. And we've learned a lot about the properties of QCD. One of the most important results is it exhibits asymptotic freedom at large momentum transfer, as exhibited by the running of the strong coupling constant becoming quite small at large relative momentum transfer. But what about other limits of QCD, like a high temperature limit and a high field strength limit? And these are limits that, in fact, we're starting to be able to access in the laboratory. And the indications are that there's very interesting physics in quantum chromodynamics other than just this extreme perturbative asymptotically free limit. And one way, in fact, we've known now almost for 20 years, you can see that there's interesting physics in QCD is by studying its thermodynamics. And the way that this has been done the most is to do it on the lattice. And I plot here results from lattice QCD calculations. On the left, it's a plot of the energy density divided by the T to the fourth, the naive dependence on temperature that you would expect. On the right, it's the pressure divided by T to the fourth. Both plotted as a function of temperature for different combinations of flavors and whether or not one actually allows dynamical quarks. But in both cases, what you see as a feature in the QCD thermodynamics is a rapid change here in the energy density by almost an order of magnitude at constant temperature. Right. And if you were to turn this on its side and look at it as a function of, if you were to plot the temperature versus the energy density, it would look like over a large range of energy densities, the temperature remains roughly constant. That's characteristic of a phase transition. Now, in fact, a lot of work has gone in to determine whether this is a true phase transition or not, and that answer is somewhat complicated. We think in the region that we're accessing in experiments, which is very low baryon number, that in fact it's not a first order phase transition, it's a smooth crossover. Nonetheless, this rapid jump in the number of degrees of freedom reflects the liberation of the quark and gluons from being confined inside hadrons to actually being the dynamical degrees of freedom in the matter. So there's a rapid crossover from confined hadronic matter to what we call the quark-gluon plasma at a temperature that's about 170 MeV and a corresponding energy density of around a GeV per femtometer cubed. Now, this is interesting because it's a fundamental characteristic of QCD. It's the only fundamental phase transition that can be studied in the laboratory. Ideally, you would like to be able to look at the electroweak transition in the laboratory and actually see what happens when one can take the energy scale so high that one can produce, you know, W's and Z's copiously so that they affect the dynamics. But there's no way we'll ever be able to do that, at least in our lifetimes. But we can do it with the strong interaction. And that in itself is interesting. The fact that it's non-abelian is interesting. And one of the questions one can immediately ask that will be relevant for my talk is the quark-gluon plasma up here weakly or strongly interacting? Okay, and you will see that, in fact, we know the answer to that question now from some of our measurements. Yes?
It's a dumb question. What's the difference between 2 plus 1 flavors and 3 flavors?
The 2 plus 1 is where one really treats the strange quark as being more massive than the others. So in fact, this is a crucial, I'm sorry, I didn't make this plot, but so if you can't quite see, there's some badly colored aqua points here that interpolate between the 2 and 3 flavor. And that's when they really try to treat the strange quark mass as being at this intermediate scale of 100 MeV. So 3 quarks would be 3 light quarks. Right, 2 quarks is essentially just 2 light quarks. You treat the strange quark to be infinitely massive. And in fact, you can see that the 2 plus 1 does smoothly interpolate as you go up in temperature between the 2 and 3 flavor.
How was the scale of 170 ABV computed?
So what they do is they calculate, they perform these computations in a particular set of lattice units that they can also measure, for example, the string tension, right, or the row mass. Okay, and then they use the physical row mass or the physical estimates for the string tension to turn the lattice parameters into an estimate of the temperature.
And the energy density?
That actually, in principle, you can get simply from looking at the derivative of this curve. It's a little bit harder when you have a pure crossover instead of a true phase transition, because one can't find a point at which the parameters change discontinuously. But basically what they do is they look at the susceptibilities, or separately the derivatives of this curve, and basically find where the variation is maximum. And there's been quite a lot of evolution in this temperature value over the years. If you do it using pure blue, where the quark's not allowed to be dynamical, then people started off getting values of 250 MeV. The first calculations with dynamical quarks came out around 150. And then for a few years, they went down to 140 MeV, approaching the pion mass. But now they've come back as people have used better lattice actions to get rid of the lattice artifacts. And in fact, the value of 170 MeV is actually very close to an empirical temperature that we get. I won't have time to talk about this, for a chemical, essentially hadronization transition that we can see by looking at abundances of different particles and different masses. And we infer a temperature for hadronization that's just around this value.
What L?
What's that?
What is the L from?
For the data or for that?
For the data.
For the data, it's, I would say, this, well, statistically it's, you know, a few MeV. Systematically, I would say it's around 5 to 10 MeV. It depends on the assumptions that you put into the thermal calculation to determine, to essentially fit the data. Yes?
This graph you showed, that looked consistent with weak interaction, didn't it?
Well, that's the interesting question. If you look at it naively, you would say that, well, this is essentially flat. It looks like you've reached, you know, essentially the Stefan-Boltzmann limit. But if you actually look, so I'm just going to come back at the end, back to the slide and show you, the Stefan-Boltzmann limit is up here. And this is about a difference of a factor of 3/4. And it's actually kind of interesting because that 3/4 can be obtained through another way, and we'll talk about that at the end. Okay, so in fact, people got fooled by this early on. They thought that this value not agreeing with the Stefan-Boltzmann limit was a lattice artifact. But now that we know better and can do better calculations, it's not. Okay, so in order to try to accomplish this transition in the laboratory, essentially going back through the transition, of course, we know one place where in the universe there was evolution through the QCD phase transition, and that was the early universe. And unfortunately, we can't go back and recreate that. And it's hard to study since all of the physics of the QCD phase transition has been obscured through later evolution. So we want to be able to try to create matter up here in the laboratory, and not do it once, but do it millions or billions of times so that we can actually study the physics in detail. So the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider was constructed at Brookhaven, filling a ring that had been built for the Isabel accelerator until it was canceled and became Wasabel. So that's a joke in Brookhaven. So RIC was built to fill a tunnel that already existed. There are two rings carrying beams that rotate in opposite directions. They can collide at 6 intersection points. There were 4 experiments when RIC started, 2 large experiments and 2 small. RIC has run for now 6 years, so we're running out of room to be able to write down all the things that RIC has done. But its primary goal is to collide heavy nuclei, because there we can create large volumes, many particles, and attempt to approach the thermodynamic limit. Whereas people have pretended that they could actually try to create the Korpilomb-Bosman PP-PP-VAR collisions, where you maybe get significant energy densities, but for so brief a period and so small a volume that it doesn't make sense to talk about matter. So we collide gold because it's one of the easiest large nuclei to collide. We use proton-proton collisions as a baseline. We did a very important deuteron-gold control measurement. I won't talk about that, although that was very important physics. Recently, we've done lighter nuclear collisions that help us understand the systematics of what we're seeing with system size. But I'm mostly going to talk about gold-gold data at the top energy of 200 GeV per nucleon.
What's the size of this?
It's a couple kilometers in circumference. Okay, so it's quite big, but not, but it's, let's say, a factor of 10 smaller than the LHC.
And then are there any issues from the fact that it's not circular?
No. I mean, it's not strictly circular just because of the way they have to implement the crossings, right? And the way one designs the lattice for the machine in order to, you know, to keep the beams from blowing up and so forth. So the fact that it's not perfectly circular is part of the design.
And since you have large curvatures, does this cause loss of energy?
If it were electrons, that would be a serious effect. But with protons, the synchrotron radiation loss is small. Now, before I go on and start talking more about the details of the physics, I want to give you some picture for how we think a Rick collision evolves, just to understand the later discussions. And this is actually... So this is a space-time diagram where each of these dots represents a possible production point for a particle, based on a crude attempt to simulate a heavy ion collision simply by trying to follow individual quark and nucleon collisions, starting with a description of the parton content of the initial nuclei. Now, we don't use that as a real model for nuclear collisions, but it's useful to give some picture for what's happening. So down here, these green dots represent gluon production from the initial crossing of the nuclei. And in fact, we think it's that initial gluon production that determines the later evolution and the formation of the quark-gluon plasma. And I will talk quite a bit about this period. And then the system develops essentially a Hubble-like expansion because the nuclei recede at the speed of light. They don't lose much of their kinetic energy. And the system in between expands, essentially as one over time. And if you look at the evolution of the matter in the in-between period, we often think of it as being essentially self-similar, that if you follow any particular straight line trajectory in space-time, then the evolution of the system in its local proper time is the same as you go from here all the way over here. Now, that's not quite true, but it's a useful picture for how the collision evolves. Now, in fact, we can divide this evolution up into four periods. The initial particle production from strong fields, I will talk about. Rapid thermalization. This is essentially an empirical observation that we don't completely understand, but will be the focus of a lot of my talk. Then, what I will term hydrodynamic evolution, where the system really behaves like a bulk system that can be described as if it were simply an ideal fluid acting under its own collective pressure and energy density. And then a later period where the system rehadronizes into hadrons. And I won't have time to talk about that, even though it's interesting. Now, to get a sense for the initial conditions at Rick, one can do a little bit of back-of-the-envelope physics to understand the scale for the energies of initial particle production. So you can just use uncertainty to look at the fluctuations in the quanta that will be on shell during the crossing time of the two nuclei. So in the center of mass, nuclei are Lorentz contracted by a factor of 100. When you apply that to the diameter of a gold nucleus, then you basically get something like 0.2 femtometers, which gives you a corresponding crossing time. When you put in the uncertainty principle, you would conclude that quanta gluons, basically, that have an energy of order GeV and above, are on shell and can be liberated during this crossing. And if you just estimate how many of those you might get out, it would be around 200 per collision. And that would give you a liberated gluon energy density of something like 10 GeV per femtometer cubed. Now, this is a really crude estimate, but it turns out to be remarkably close to at least an order of magnitude to what we get from actually analyzing the data. Yes?
So you can rule this question out, but if where it's very strong fields of QCT, do we think we really know what a gluon is?
That's the interesting question. Yes, the answer is yes. The issue is that it's not so much, you can always do the Weizacker-Williams description, right, of the field and evaluate the gluon content. The issue is that when you write out the evolution equations for the partonic content, you no longer have to worry, you no longer can only worry about gluon emission. You have to worry about absorption processes, essentially recombination. And so the people who are working in this, I would say, the idea that one can talk about a gluon distribution doesn't go away even when you reach the strong field limit, but you have to modify how you think about the gluon evolution in order to take into account recombination effects. And I will describe this on the next slide. So this is a cartoon version, and I'll do a little bit more rigorous version of what we think the physics is going on, because this idea of gluon liberation, I mean, uncertainty arguments are useful to sort of set the scale, but they're not nearly good enough. But one of the things that was recognized early on, that when you have highly Lorentz contracted nuclei, that the soft gluons, which have relatively low energy, are not going to be contracted along with everything else. And in fact, they'll overlap over the entire thickness of the nuclei, which essentially raises the gluon density compared to what you would expect in a single nucleon by a factor of, let's say, 6. And when those gluons overlap, it was realized pretty early on that they could recombine. And this is actually a diagram that appears in a calculation by Al Mueller and his collaborators early on, describing what this physics would look like, where effectively, in the fluctuations of the nucleus before it interacts, one has gluons that recombine to produce another gluon. The gluon number in principle goes down, but it's transverse momentum spectrum. So this is a spectrum of gluons as a function of their transverse momentum. It shifts outward because one adds up several gluons to get the actual gluons that collide. And when you describe this process, formally, you end up with a new scale appearing in the problem that's often called the saturation scale, which determines the typical KT distribution of the gluons. And of course, when that scale becomes large compared to lambda QCD, then one in principle has the ability to do perturbative calculations. It's a different kind of perturbative calculation than collinearly factorized QCD. But that's where people are actually working and trying to do detailed calculations in the strong field limit. And in fact, it's thought that at RIC, this value of QS could be reaching values greater than a GeV, maybe even 2 GeV. So this process is called saturation. It's really a result of unitarity in QCD. One can look at it from a different point of view of evolution. So one of the things we know about color particles like quarks is that they radiate copiously, right? So this is just a cartoon of a quark radiating before one of the constituents of a proton interacts during a hard scattering. And this radiation changes the distribution of the partons inside the proton. It generates a lot of lower energy quarks and gluons, mostly gluons, and QQ bar pairs, and it results in a large growth of the gluon content in the proton with momentum transfer. So this is a plot of the parton distribution function in a proton as a function of parton fractional momentum at a particular Q squared, 10 GeV squared, which is not that big. And already, even at a modest Q squared, the gluon distribution is growing very rapidly at low x values. And that growth at low x is a result of this branching process. Now, it's been realized that if this were to go on forever, one would run into severe unitarity problems in QCD, that those problems can be fixed by introducing into the evolution equations the possibility of gluons to recombine. And this QS scale, when viewed from the point of view of evolution, determines where recombination starts to dominate. And the interesting thing is that you get a limiting density that goes like QS squared divided by the coupling constant, where, in fact, when one gets a density going like 1 over the coupling constant, that's characteristic of classical occupation numbers in the field. And so people use this argument, in fact, more detailed arguments than what I've shown here, to show or to say that when one is working in a region where the parton distributions saturate due to this recombination effect, one is working in a classical field region of QCD. And this is a more formal argument that basically gets to the same point. One writes down the number of gluons per unit area in terms of the parton distribution. You put in the recombination cross-section. You evaluate the scale at which the likelihood for recombination is of order 1. You get that it's related to alpha s and the density. And if you invert this, you find that the density goes as 1 over the coupling constant.
Are you talking about situation after the collision? Or is
this, well, no. See, this is...
this is still a little way of looking at the freely propagated...
This is looking at... in fact, it's not even that. You're looking at... this is a space-like parton shower. These are not real partons. What you're really looking at is a fluctuation in the wave function of the nucleus that if you didn't collide would have no effect, right? It would just fluctuate and then the fluctuation would go away and nothing would happen. But because at RIC, and particularly at the LHC, you can capture these fluctuations over a very short time interval, right? Where essentially by uncertainty this cascade can become quite large. Then you have the ability to probe the gluon content when these recombination effects dominate. So it's in the initial state, not in the final state.
Something like an effect like a running of the parton content with energy, or something like
that. Well, that's not surprising. The running of the I didn't show you the Q squared evolution, but if you look at these distributions as a function of Q squared, this thing, the gluon content will go rapidly here. That's not the surprising part. The surprising part is that the recombination effects appear to actually slow down that growth. And that's something that has not been seen before, except in the last, I would say, 4 years, people have been working at Hera and may, in fact, have already identified this physics being present in measurements of the deep inelastic scattering cross-section at Hera. So this is a bit of a change from what I was describing, but it's a different way to get at the same physics. So this is a plot of the virtual gamma proton cross-section. So if you will, if you imagine a unitarity diagram, if you make a cut here, then you're talking about deep inelastic scattering. Whereas if you basically calculate this full thing, you're calculating the gamma star p cross-section. You can take the data to measure this gamma star p cross-section. And this is a whole set of data at different parton x values and different resolution scales that have all been put onto a single curve simply by hypothesizing that the data can be understood in terms of this scaling variable. If you know the momentum transfer of the collision, and you divide by a empirical saturation scale, all of the x dependence in the distributions goes in here, and one gets a universal curve. And this is a really stunning empirical result. There's no theory that directly predicted this. So the people who came up with this idea saw it as purely empirical result. It's termed geometric scaling. Now, in the meantime, there's been a tremendous amount of theoretical work to demonstrate that, in fact, one expects this geometric scaling as a precursor to saturation in the evolution of the parton distributions. And people working in the field of this low-x physics and studying the physics of saturation have demonstrated that this simple scaling is a natural feature of that problem. Now, this is relevant to Rick, and the reason I'm talking about it, because one of the first surprises from Rick was that the multiplicities we saw in the final state were small. To give you a sense of what I'll be talking about throughout my whole talk when I use the term centrality, you can think of two nuclei colliding in a very classical way. There is a distance between their centers in the transverse plane that we call the impact parameter. It's a classical impact parameter. The nuclei, one might be going this way, one might be going that way. At high energies, we don't think of them as having individual nucleons that independently scatter, but it's still useful to talk about the number of nucleons that essentially undergo at least one hadronic scattering during the collision. And we call that the number of participants. And that's essentially a quantitative way to say how much the two nuclei overlap. So this is a plot of the multiplicity of particles we see at 90 degrees as a function of this number of participants. And here's the data. And our naive expectation, based on our understanding of the contributions from QCD, was the black line. And we expected that it would grow very rapidly with the number of participants. And the data started higher, but in fact went up very, very slowly as we changed the overlap between the two nuclei. The only prediction of this result came from calculations that used the same saturation physics that I described to you before. Effectively, the argument is that the slower growth in the gluon content is what's responsible for the very slow evolution here in the number of particles we see at red. And this was a very striking result and was unexpected. Provides one way of interpreting the Rick data, suggesting that, in fact, the saturation physics is there in the initial state. Now, there's more experimental results that support the saturation picture. I won't have time to go into them, but it's very important that this picture actually applies because it gives us an easy way to understand the initial state. That we're not starting from some very complicated mixture of nucleons and hadrons and something interacting. That the initial state is purely gluonic, well, with some quark-antiquark production coming from the gluon splitting, but that we have a well-defined initial state that starts off purely partonic, and it starts off in a form that in principle can be calculated from first, can be calculated ab initio. Now, I would say the saturation calculations aren't there to be truly described as ab initio yet, but the fact that one has a perturbative value for QS means that we have a hope of getting there. So we have an initial state that we understand. We're producing a lot of gluons from strong fields. The next question then is, did we succeed in actually creating matter? And one way you can answer that question is to look at one of these events and just take one event, although we typically do this for many events at the same time where we line up the appropriate angles. But you can take one event and look at the distribution of particles as a function of the azimuthal angle. Now, if this were ordinary high energy physics, let's say neglecting spin effects, there would be nothing to break the azimuthal symmetry, and the number of particles as you go around in phi should be constant. If you actually look at the data, you see something quite different. We see that the variation in the number of particles as you go around azimuth is enormous. There's this huge modulation that, in fact, is very well described by a cosine of twice the angle. And this was very striking. It wasn't a complete surprise to see such modulation because it had been seen at lower energies. But it was a surprise that we saw it at Rick and that it was so big. Where does it come from? Well, the physics that breaks the azimuthal anisotropy is the fact that if you have two nuclei overlapping in the initial state, so basically you imagine the projection of two spheres, they don't completely overlap, then the region in which the particles are interacting and which the energy is being deposited is asymmetric. It's longer in this direction than in the side direction. That means that you have a distribution of density that has a larger gradient this way than that way. And that means that if you develop pressure, the pressure will be more effective pushing in this direction than in that direction. And in fact, we now understand this strong modulation as being a result of self-generated pressure in the quark wall plasma, forcing particles to go more in the sideways direction than in the, let's call it, the up and down direction. Now, this is a cartoon, but we can do better by characterizing the magnitude of this modulation, comparing to the actual spatial eccentricity of the overlap region. So that's what's shown on the on these curves. So we call this parameter V2. So if you parameterize the phi distribution as having a cosine modulation, the V2 parameter sets the amplitude. It's just, if you will, the Fourier amplitude of the cos 2 phi component. On the left-hand side is a plot of that parameter versus transverse momentum for data of different kinds of particles and a certain set of theoretical calculations that do a ridiculously good job of describing the data, let's say, down here. And I won't talk so much about the distinction between the physics below a GeV and above a GeV, but there's reasons that one should expect the physics to be different. On the right-hand side, we take that same parameter and divide by the spatial eccentricity defined this way. So it's the mean y squared minus x squared over the mean average sum. So that determines whether we're longer this way than that way. And if you scale this amplitude by the spatial anisotropy, and plot that as a function of the number of particles per transverse area, essentially produced at 90 degrees, then you can plot the data from RIC, which are the black points. You can also plot data from lower energies, which are down here. And you see at lower energies, we saw such an effect, but it was relatively weak. But at RIC, this effect becomes very large, and it approaches these green lines, which are the results of a calculation where we assume that the quarks and gluons interact with zero mean free path, which is really shocking, because no one expected that the physics at RIC should be describable in terms of quark and gluon interactions with such short scattering lengths. Now, I'm going to skip a discussion of hydrodynamics. I will simply flash this slide, which is a measurement of that parameter that determines the modulation as a function of the transverse momentum, which is sensitive to the viscosity of the medium. The viscosity is a way of characterizing the, essentially, the dispersion in the medium. The larger the viscosity, the more dissipative the interaction is, the longer the mean free path of the particles is. And if you look at this plot comparing the data to the various curves, one naively would guess that the viscosity as represented by this parameter, it's really the ratio of the viscosity to the specific entropy, is of order zero. And that would imply, in fact, that the system is behaving like a perfectly ideal fluid. And if you took that number at face value and plotted essentially the viscosity divided by the entropy density as a function of temperature, inferred from the data would be this red line for the quark gluon plasma that we're creating in the laboratory. And here would represent the values for liquid helium, liquid nitrogen, water. It looks like the quark gluon plasma is an order of magnitude smaller than any other fluid that's been created in the laboratory. And in fact, this is what gave rise to statements coming out of the RIC community that the quark gluon plasma is the most perfect fluid. But we can do better than that. People are working on the lattice to estimate what this ratio should be of the viscosity to the entropy density. Their error bars are still quite large right now, but these are the values. This is a limit that I will talk about later. This is the perturbative estimates that you would get on the basis of naive scattering cross-sections. And you can see that lattice QCD suggests that the mean free path in the medium should also be quite small. And this leads to the conclusion that the physics at RIC is strong coupling. Another reason to think that this description of the data is accurate is that simple hydrodynamics can actually very accurately predict not only the elliptic flow, but the spectrum of particles in the final state. So if one measures different kinds of mesons and baryons, and measures their spectrum as a function of transverse momentum, you can describe the data remarkably well. Not only that, but this is a new calculation that tries to estimate the viscosity using non-ideal hydrodynamics. The problem is that when you do viscous hydrodynamics, the plain old Navier-Stokes has problems with causality in relativistic calculations. And if you fix those up, you can do that, but you have to introduce a new parameter, which sort of weakens the bound that we can put on the viscosity to the entropy ratio. And here the author concludes that it's less than 0.5, which is still low, but it's not so tiny. The one thing is that this calculation does not also calculate the elliptic flow, so it may not be the final story. Now, one possibility for physics that can lead to this strong coupling in an unexpected way is the possibility that one generates plasma instabilities in the medium. And non-abelian plasma instabilities are similar to abelian plasma instabilities. And I'll point you down here to a little diagram to help understand what's going on. So you imagine you have a medium that has nominally got color currents. And if they're always, if they're isotropic, nothing much happens. But if you have a fluctuation where, for example, there's a little bit more current going this way than in the opposite direction, it generates a chromomagnetic field. And that chromomagnetic field acts to squeeze that current down and increase the chromomagnetic field, which basically squeezes it down some more until one gets rapid growth of strong chromomagnetic fields in the medium and population of low frequency modes associated with those strong fields. And this is a plot of the energy density in these chromomagnetic fields as a function of time, showing sort of rapid exponential growth in sort of an abelian-like instability, and then a region where it becomes more sort of non-abelian. And this is one possibility for essentially providing thermalization in the medium, where these strong magnetic fields, just like ordinary electromagnetic fields, bend the colored particles, redistribute the energy, and essentially keep the system looking as if it's in thermal equilibrium. Now, we don't know if these fields really grow fast enough, but it's one hypothesis for what's going on at RIC that one generates strong interactions through these plasma instabilities. Now, another way we have of knowing that the system is exhibiting these unexpectedly strong interactions is we do a classic physicist trick, which is if you want to understand something, you shoot an energetic particle through it and see what happens to that energetic particle. So we do this in heavy ion collisions. We shoot energetic particles through them. But those energetic particles are self-generated quarks and gluons and photons that come from hard scattering processes between the incident partons. So when two nuclei collide, most of the interactions are soft, but sometimes there's a hard scattering producing a multiple GeV quark and gluon that goes out at 90 degrees. Those then fragment, but they penetrate through much of the medium that is hot and in the form of quark-gluon plasma. And we expect, in fact, that the energy loss of the quarks and gluons will be larger in that kind of medium, in the quark-gluon plasma. So here's a cartoon. We have a hard scattering process in the background of a hot matter that is essentially quark-gluon plasma. And we want to look at the energy loss of those quarks and gluons. Now, ideally, we would do what high energy physicists do, which is look at all the energy associated with a quark or a gluon and see that energy either reduced or distributed differently. The problem is at RIC is there's so much background of all the particles, all those thousands of particles, that we can't look at all of the energy in what's called a jet. So we have to take one particle at a time. So, for example, we might take these red particles. Now, this physics is actually kind of interesting. The mechanism by which the energy is lost, we think it's dominated by bremsstrahlung-like gluon emission. But because the gluons are non-abelian and there's Landau-Pomeranchuk Migdal type formation time effects, the dominant physics is where one has virtual gluons propagating along with the quark that would normally just be reabsorbed and there'd be no energy loss. But those virtual gluons can actually scatter in the medium, be emitted as real gluons, and thus basically increase the energy loss of the quark. And this is essentially a diagram in a calculation. But it also shows that very well. This is a gluon that's emitted, it might have been reabsorbed, but it interacts in the medium and gets emitted as real radiation, leading to energy loss. So I will skip this. We have enough knowledge about QCD in order to be able to predict the number of hard scattering particles, the rate of hard scattering, and the number of these energetic particles coming out, that we can use PP measurements as a control and then predict in heavy ion collisions how many of these energetic particles we should see. And the change in the number, the change in the momentum distribution will tell us how the quarks and gluons are losing energy in the quark-gluon plasma. So here's, for example, a plot of raw data. The black points are measurements in gold-gold collisions, and this is a cartoon showing that these are collisions where we've selected the events to have low multiplicity, relatively little overlap. These data points, high multiplicity, quite a lot of overlap. The red curves show you what we expect on the basis of perturbative QCD and factorization. For these kinds of collisions, our expectation matches up very well with the data. But for what we call central collisions, where the multiplicities and the energy densities in the medium are larger, there's a substantial suppression of this most energetic set of particles. And if you plot the ratio of what we see to what we expect, that's the right-hand plot, then you get these data points. Okay? And in fact, out close to 10 GeV, and I'll show you this now extended on twice the scale in a minute, we see a factor of 5 suppression in the number of particles that we expect. That can only be explained in the context of this stimulated energy loss. Now, I'm just going to show you, this is spectra taken with much higher statistics, where we do the same thing. We look at this ratio of what we measure to what we expect over a much larger transverse momentum range, where we make the overlap between the nuclei successively bigger. And you can see that this suppression coming from the energy loss just keeps getting stronger and stronger until over the entire transverse momentum range that we see, there's a suppression of something like a factor of 5. Now, the fact that there was suppression wasn't surprising. The degree of suppression was a little surprising. Here's a calculation that relies on very little sort of model input. It has some theoretical approximations in it, but it essentially relies on a temperature and the QCD approximations that have gone into the energy loss calculations, and that's it. And one actually gets a rather good representation of the amount of what we call jet quenching that's seen in the data. Now, we have a calibration for this effect, because the same hard scattering processes that generate quarks and gluons also generate photons. So you can take the same cartoon, but now replace one of the quarks with a photon and verify that the photon that's penetrating should see no effect, okay, while the jets, the quarks and gluons that are losing energy, do see an effect. And so if we have the process well calibrated and we understand energy loss properly, there should be no effect in the photons. And that's exactly what we see. So this is the same ratio, what we detect to what we naively expect on the basis of perturbative QCD. Here's the data points that I showed you before, but now plotted as a function of the overlap characterized by this number of participants. And here's the photons. Now the error bars here are not great. We've got more precise data in hand now that's in the process of being published, but it doesn't change the conclusion that essentially there's little or no suppression in the photons, and there's factor of 5 suppression coming from the hadrons. And so if you put those two together, you get this picture, photons, the hadrons showing a factor of 5 suppression. if you interpret the energy densities needed to explain the suppression, you get something like 15 GeV per cubic femtometer, which is 10 times the critical energy density. So this is, in fact, quite good agreement with this very naive expectation. But that's not the whole point. The point here is that we're seeing the effect of a colored particle interacting in what is clearly colored matter. Okay. And this is quite a striking effect, that we can actually do such an experiment and see the QCD interactions leading to the energy loss of these colored particles in this matter. I'm going to skip this for sake of time. However, in addition to just looking at one particle, one can use the fact that jets have to be produced in pairs. So there should be momentum balance in the outgoing quarks and gluons. This is actually a real hard scattering event from star in PP collisions, where you see two quarks or gluons coming out, producing several particles. We call those jets. And there's good momentum balance in the transverse plane. Now, because we can only look in heavy ion collisions at one or two particles, we can't do this, because this is superimposed on that picture with thousands of particles. But we can look at pairs taken one at a time, or taken two at a time. So for example, if we take two hadrons from the final state and look at their opening angle in azimuth and plot all possible pairs, then you get this distribution where you see a peak at zero when you select pairs from one of these jets. Then you see a peak at 180 degrees where you pick one of the hadrons from here and one of the hadrons from over there. But this is in PP collisions where things are clean. When you go to heavy ion collisions, this is what you see. So you see the pairs coming from a single jet, and you don't see the pairs where we get one hadron from one jet and one hadron from the other jet. Basically, it looks like you're only getting one jet at a time. And we think this is a relatively straightforward effect of this energy loss process, with some effect from geometric bias, that when you see one of these particles coming out, it's more likely to come from the surface, because that has less energy loss. And the particle that goes on the other side, balancing the energy, on average goes through more of the medium, and therefore loses more energy. So this is a striking but relatively straightforward result of jet quenching. But this is old, and in the meantime, we've learned something more about that physics. So this is the same plot, now blown up a little bit, but with much higher statistics, where we have three different plots corresponding to different amounts of overlap between the two nuclei. The blue is very like PP collisions, and then the black and the red have successively more overlap between the nuclei. And you see something that was just completely stunning. This jet signal goes away, and you see this peak, two peaks, appear that just have no business being there. In QCD, there's no mechanism to generate contributions from here. So somehow, these things which are clearly coming from hard scattering, this thing really does look like an ordinary jet, but whatever is balancing it looks completely different. This is a different way of plotting that same picture that gives you a hint at the physics, where we just take those distributions, we wrap them around the circle in phi. So basically, this corresponds to 0 degree opening angle. This is 180 degrees. This is our peak corresponding to particles from the same jet. This is a peak from 180 degrees. But then as you make the overlap between the nuclei bigger, you start developing these lobes roughly 60 degrees from the pi, from the backside direction. Now, that 60 degrees is actually rather interesting, because if you plot the data and a cartoon of what a particle propagating faster than the speed of sound in the quark-gluon plasma might do if it were generating a shock front, it doesn't take much imagination to see that the particles coming from the shock are going to go that way, and that way, and that looks a lot like the yield of particles we see going that way and that way. So this is my pun. This is a shock wave from a jet.
What speed is the jet?
What's that? Oh, hang on, so we're getting there. Now, this is a more serious analysis of, so the black points are data. The black curve is a serious attempt to put in what we know about the speed of sound in QCD and actually compare to the data. In ideal four-quantum plasma, the speed of sound squared is 1/3. And if you put in the fact that the cosine of the angle, if you have a half angle of the cone, should be equal to the speed of sound, that would predict a Mach angle of 55 degrees, which would be here. The peak is actually a little bit shifted to the right. Okay? And we think the reason for that is that the medium that the jets are propagating through is not the ideal quark-gluon plasma, because they're seeing the whole evolution from quark-gluon plasma all the way through to hadronization. And the speed of sound evolves, and one can evaluate it in terms of the equation of state this way, and you should expect not to see only contributions at the ideal point, but at a point where the speed of sound is lower. In fact, right at the phase transition, naively, you might expect the speed of sound to go to zero. But in fact, we can get quite a good description of the signature that's seen in the data, treating it as a shock wave. Now, this would be really, really remarkable, because it would mean not only can we see the energy loss of colored particles propagating in the medium, but it would mean that we have direct sensitivity to the equation of state, because we can measure the sound velocity. Yes?
You said speed of sound goes to zero. Is that, I assume it's for the second order phase transition?
Well, strictly speaking, yes. So it doesn't, you know, in real QCD, it might not exactly go to zero, but analyses of the equation of state from the lattice, in fact, indicate that it would go quite small. Mm-hmm. Now, there are possible other mechanisms proposed to explain this result, but I think the general sense of people in the field is that those other mechanisms are not somehow, they're more ad hoc, they're harder to make internally consistent. We can't yet really claim that we're seeing Mach cones, shock waves generated by quarks propagating in the medium, but we may be able to do so soon. There are many other measurements I'm not showing you here that will allow us to determine that. What did that show you? This, I mean, there's a huge amount of data from it that I can't talk to you about because there's no time. We see charm quarks are also quenched, which is surprising because they're heavy, and the radiated energy loss should be suppressed due to their heavier mass. They also rapidly thermalize, which would be consistent with the strong coupling that we see from the elliptic flow. We see a large baryon excess that isn't easily understood unless you suppose, well, unless you hypothesize, that the baryons are being produced by taking three thermal quarks out of the medium in order to produce their energy. Whereas when you only take two quarks out of the medium to produce mesons, they get less boost. And so you would expect this mechanism of sort of thermalizing hadrons by coalescing quarks to give you an excess baryon to meson ratio. That is a naive idea, and then if you do it in detail, one gets ridiculously good agreement with the data. And all indications are that we see the real effects of hadronization in the final state momentum spectra for the baryons and for the mesons.
Sorry, you're saying there's no hadron forming in the meson?
There's what?
Here.
In a particular energy range, right? Essentially where the steepness of the spectrum from sort of the, let's say, the pure soft production would make the contribution small to the protons, but then this coalescence, basically producing them by three quarks out of the medium, dominates. Okay, and in that region, we see that there's as many baryons as there are mesons, which is not what you'd expect. You'd expect like a factor of five difference. And I didn't put it here just because if I start talking about that, I'll go on another 10 minutes. But it's a really striking signature. And actually, if you plot this elliptic flow parameter that I showed you, divided by the number of quarks as a function of the kinetic energy divided by the number of quarks. For baryons and mesons, they fall on a universal curve, right? So it really looks like the final state is, you know, the final state hadrons are a very naive combination of quarks being, you know, thermalized out of the vacuum into the mesons and baryons. And we see final state particle flavor distributions consistent with freeze out from a chemically equilibrated system. And no one at RIC officially, right, the RIC community has not stood up and said, we've seen the quark-muon plasma. But it's clear that we're at a point where there's no other viable interpretation of all the data. So, a summary of RIC physics. Since the start of RIC, there's been substantial progress in development of a rigorous foundation for understanding nearly every stage of a heavy ion collision. Particle production from strong gluon fields. Thermalization we can see empirically, but we don't understand why it happens yet. There are some ideas, like the plasma instabilities, but we're not certain. The hydrodynamic evolution seems to be a fact for whatever mechanism is doing the thermalization. We see the hadronization, and in fact, we can analyze it on the basis of analytic simple physics prescriptions that we wouldn't have necessarily believed should work. But this is very important because prior to RIC, when people did heavy ion physics, the interpretation of the data was a complete mess. We couldn't control any of the calculations for any aspect of the collision. Right? There was nothing rigorous. Everything was a guess. Everything was a model. But the saturation analyses of the particle production from strong gluon fields, they're not completely, you know, true theory as opposed to model, but they're much, much, much closer than we had anything before RIC. Hydrodynamics is a real robust and rigorous calculational framework as long as one understands the approximations that are intrinsic in it. And our understanding of hadronization is getting to the point where we can actually calculate some of the effects, even if we don't understand hadronization as a physics process yet. So that's very good. And we have jets as a calibrated probe. A lot of the physics of jet quenching isn't completely understood yet. But we clearly see the effects of jet quenching. We can estimate some of the properties of the medium. And I would say we're already probing the properties of quark-muon plasma with surprising results. We see strong coupling. We don't yet know why. We may even be able to see the effects of the speed of sound. Now, if you will bear with me just for a couple more minutes, I'll go back to this slide and talk about this arrow down here pointing to something that's called the viscosity bound. Right? And what is the viscosity bound? So a simple way to say it is, this is a calculation of the viscosity of the quark-muon plasma using string theory. Right? Okay, now this is a different audience. Normally when I give this kind of talk, you know, nobody in the audience would expect that to be true, right? So, you know, the response I expect is, what? How can one calculate the viscosity of something using string theory? Well, many of you in the audience, in fact, know the answer to this and know it much, much better than I do. But the main idea is that there's a duality between string theory and five-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space and certain kinds of conformal field theories, such that one can do weakly coupled calculations in string theory that correspond to strongly coupled conformal field theory calculations. The fact that the RIC data suggests strong coupling has taken this from a very nice theoretical analysis to something that could have direct experimental impact. And one example, conformal theory, is a supersymmetric Yang-Mills, which is not quite QCD. But the interesting question is it close enough to QCD to actually make the use of this correspondence applicable to RIC data? And many people think the answer is maybe or yes, because in fact, there are a number of calculations that are calculating, for example, the viscosity, property of jet quenching, and the property of sound waves that in fact may be directly related to measurements that we're making at RIT. So you should talk to your friends here who do string theory to get a better understanding of it. My take on this is that it's a really nice idea, that it's plausible, and if it turns out to be true, it would be incredible. But we still have to see whether all the caveats in here, okay, turn out to be good enough. But I would say we'll know more in a couple of years. But a few years ago, I would never expected that we would be talking about using string theory calculations to understand RIT data. All right, just a couple minutes more. There's a lot of excitement about the possibility of doing the same kinds of measurements at the LHC. To give you some sense of why you'd want to do it, I show two plots here. One is a plot of the cross-section for producing various kinds of hard scattering probes of final states, pions, at the LHC versus RIC. And you see at the Large Hadron Collider, one just has a much larger cross-section for very, very large energy jets and quarks and gluons and individual high energy particles. And this is very important because if we can get out here, the energies of the jets will be high enough that we can actually see the complete jet. And that will be a tremendous benefit in resolving some of the uncertainties that we have in understanding the jet quenching results. And when we understand, when we fix those uncertainties, it'll turn into a much more precise probe of the medium. In addition, on the right-hand side is a plot of what kinematics we can access at the LHC. So this is essentially Q squared versus X. And it's at low X where all of the saturation physics is accessible. At RIC, we're sort of working at fractional momentum values down to 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4. At the LHC, we will push down to 10 to the minus 6, where the saturation scale may become as large as 4 GeV. So we're going to extend to much lower X and understand the physics of the strong fields and the particle production from it better. The initial energy density, in fact, this is now an old estimate. People are pushing this number up to 200 GeV per femtometer cubed. So 200 times the critical energy density. Large jet rates, we will be able to do full jet reconstruction. And in fact, the detectors are already there. Now, there's a dedicated detector called ELISE that is focused on heavy ion measurements. But I'm working on ATLAS, which was designed for PP collisions. But in fact, we'll be able to do very good measurements in heavy ion collisions, particularly of jet observables. So I'm going to skip some of this stuff because I've already discussed it. Just give you a couple measurements that we're able to do. Day one, we only need like 100 events, and we'll be able to measure the number of particles using the same plot that I showed you for RIC. Okay, but now with the LHC, except I'm plotting it here as a function of root S. Here's RIC data. There are different extrapolations to the LHC. Here's, for example, what the saturation physics would predict. The first day measurement would allow us to test whether saturation physics is in fact correct. The other thing is we can do these elliptic flow measurements and extend this horizontal scale and seeing the growth of the magnitude of the elliptic flow and test whether this keeps going up, which would be surprising and would say that we may not understand the physics at RIC. If it flattens off, which is maybe what we would naively expect if there's still strong coupling at the LHC or comes back down. And we will be able to do this almost immediately after the LHC turns on. It turns out ATLAS is particularly good for this because it's got such a large acceptance. So let me summarize and stop here. So, there's a real opportunity at the LHC for doing the physics that I described even better. Okay, and stay tuned. In a few years, you'll hear those results. Those results, if anything, are going to be more exciting than at RIC. And I'll just point out that all of the things I've talked about imply overlap of this field with many other subfields of physics. And to me, that's been one of the most fulfilling aspects of working in this particular problem is that it's drawing in ideas from almost every other field of physics because it's all in there. And now we have the detectors and the ability to actually separate out all of that different physics and make sense of it. Okay, thank you.
some stuff there. We have time for just a couple of questions. And then Brian's here the rest of the day. So let's have some good questions. Raphael.
Some point you pointed to one-third of the speed of sound that you would
expect. CS squared, right, yeah.
CS squared. P over rho, basically. But mm-hmm. If it's strong coupling, why should you... I mean, doesn't that come from a sort of free particle model? So if it's strong coupling, wouldn't you expect it to be shifted by
yes.
density associated?
So, excellent question. And the answer is yes. However, so absolutely. In fact, let me go back to one of the first plots I showed you. This plot. Right. So this is a plot of the, well, in fact, what you really need is a ratio of this one to this one. But both the pressure and the energy density are lowered from their Stefan-Boltzmann limit by about a factor of 3/4. So if you actually take the ratio, it starts off up here not being so different from 1/3. However, it's here where you can see the pressure evolving, where the energy density is remaining roughly constant. And that's the speed of sound going down. Okay. So you're absolutely right that in this region, you don't expect 1/3. You expect something less. But up here, basically, even though they're not at the Stefan-Boltzmann limit, and in fact, this is interesting because that factor of 3/4 difference between that plateau and what you would expect from an ideal gas is predictable on the basis of ADS CFT. But because it's roughly the same factor here and here, the 1/3 still remains.
So you're saying there's some way of understanding why it's the same factor? I mean, even why does it look flat? Is there a way of understanding why it looks flat?
That's a good question. You should ask one of the people here who knows more about ADS-CFT where this factor of 3/4 really comes.
This is the famous factor of 3/4 in the thermal.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that was.
Well, I don't know how famous it is, right? I mean,
it was famous as a mystery, not as an explanation or something.
Well, you could say that ADS-CFT doesn't explain it. It just is a way of calculating it, right? We don't quite know why it's there. Now, there are people who do QCD thermal field theory, right, using something called hard thermal loop calculations that allow them to essentially extend the field theory into a region where you wouldn't necessarily expect it to apply. They can show that effective masses for the quarks and gluons can account for some of this effect. Okay, so maybe that's a more physics explanation for it. But the striking thing is that this factor of 3/4 can come out simply from using the ADS-CFT correspondence.
Using some magnetic mass, screening effect,
yes.
Explains that too, or do you get...
That gets complicated. I mean, some of it's magnetic screen mass, and some of it's, true thermal masses, right? So it's a combination of the two effects. And the details of that, in fact, get very nasty because it involves the properties of the... gluon inside the medium, right? What the longitudinal and the transverse gluon propagator dispersion relations look like in the medium. But in the end, it's a combination of both.
You're not saying this mass explains the 3/4 factor,
It can explain some of the reduction. Yes. No. It can explain some of the reduction. And the thing is, they can extrapolate into, let's say down to about here. Before the resummation calculation sort of start to no longer be possible.
Because if there's really a mass, you wouldn't expect the Stefan-Boltzmann form at all. In the regime where the mass is.
Well, that's the interesting thing is that the calculations show that the evolution of that contribution is slow, such that on this scale, right, if you plotted logarithm of t, right, then of course you'd see something different, that it's not flat, right, that it's rising towards an asymptotic value.
Well, in string quarters, in string theory, you do the computation in conformal theory. So you have a plot.
So it's not a surprise. So once the pressure is, say, the energy density is a factor 3/4 less, then the first law of thermodynamics tells you that the same must be with the other thing. What is true is that if you look in ADS-CFT at the series which are not conformal, and you see a plateau like that. So there is, you just do the computation following the standard way of computing stress energy tensor and evaluating energy and pressure, and you find out that there is a plateau, even though it's not supposed to be, because now you have a scale. And the plateau is precisely at the temperature scale of what is the intrinsic scale, the phase scale invariance in this year.
But does the computation affect you to understand the physics of
no, it's not, it doesn't, no. But that's not, as you just heard, it's not a pattern. So you, there is a method, hard thermal loop approach, but it's, you're sort of pushing perturbative like analysis in the regime where it's not applicable.
Well, that's right. So one could argue about, you know, the people who do these hard thermal loop calculations say, they can get down to, let's say, 300 MeV. It's a good question whether that really works, right? We were having a discussion over lunch, right? In QCD, it's easy to say where things should work, right? It's harder to say where things should break down, right? And there are places where calculations seem to work well beyond outside the range that they would expect. But it could very well be that the hard thermal loop simply just doesn't work properly in this region, and that it's, you know, something else, right? That they're only getting the asymptotic part of the slope correctly. I'm sorry, I don't have the plot. In fact, the calculations do match the value and the slope down to around 300 MeV. Yes?
What are those different curves then?
So that corresponds to how many flavors you have. So how many quark flavors. So these are two flavor, three flavor, and Lee was asking about this other one, which is 2+1, where one actually puts in the fact that the strange quark is neither light nor really heavy, right? It's, in fact, here it's of order the temperature, so it's sort of maximally weird.
Can you have more than?
Well, you can, I mean, but the thing is, one has to get to very high temperatures before you can really create a lot of charm, anti-charm in the medium, right? So if you get to temperatures GeV, maybe even 2 GeV, then one has to start worrying about the charm as a dynamical component. But at these temperatures, the charm is suppressed, so it's a tiny perturbation.
If you have more flavors, can you increase that, can you approach exactly step on those?
Well, that's, of course, the interesting question, right? I mean, if you take the strong coupling calculation seriously, the answer might be no, right? That there's real physics that suppresses these down from the Stefan-Boltzmann limit, right? I mean, you would not expect a lot of charm contribution here. Now, the interesting thing is the LHC is, you know, we, in fact, may get us to 800 MeV, right? So somewhere out here, right? And, you know, if you look at the evolution of this trajectory, right? Maybe one wouldn't expect much variation. And then the real question is, will the data from the LHC be consistent with, you know, these plots? Will we still see what looks like strong coupling phenomena? And that will be the exciting thing. I mean, it won't be very long after the LHC starts running and we'll have an answer to that question.
Okay, other questions? Anybody else?
You want to say one?
What's the
subindex
of this is
epsilon? This is epsilon.
Sorry,
which?
Too much.
A subindex of epsilon over 3 to the 4.
Stefan-Boltzmann. Yeah. It's not C. Yes. It's probably a long shot, but I mean, there was presumably a quark to add positive plasma early in the universe. If its properties are different than what people were expecting, is there any hope of any kind of signature?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I think, you know, let's say if you go back 4 years, people had basically concluded that the QCD phase transition had no real observable signatures in the universe, except for the possibility of, Dan Sun has done some work on the possibility of generating magnetic fields in the early universe from the QCD phase transition. However, because I took the plot out, but if this is true, and therefore it's different from what people naively expected, it's possible that there's some remnant signature, right? But my guess, I'm not an astrophysicist, so you'd have to ask one of them to answer the question. I guess my answer would be that the kinds of things people have looked at, like Big Bang, nuclear synthesis, we just don't have enough experimental data to really pin down whether there are observable effects or not. And the rate at which the energy density, let's say the number density in the universe, changed as a function of time was greatest right at the QCD phase transition. It happened so quickly that it's hard to imagine that even the three-quarters changed. The thing is that because of the same factors in both, the equation of state is largely unmodified up here, right? And it's only in this region that one might see an effect. My guess is that the universe went through the phase transition so quickly that all the effects are lost. But I don't know. I mean, you'd have to talk to somebody who actually studies Big Bang nuclear synthesis and I would be surprised, right? I mean, because we're talking about, the baryon asymmetry had to already be there, right? Because that, presumably that's at electroweak scales, right? So it's already there. If you were talking about the separation, in other words, if you were arguing, could there have been separation at the QCD phase transition that wasn't earlier?
But I mean, this difference would persist at all higher energies, or at much higher energies.
What's that?
The difference between the naive particle and plasma.
Well, sure, but once you get into the electroweak region, right, then that's a completely different equation of state, right? Now you're being dominated by the electroweak interactions. So, but I'm not very qualified to be talking about.
Right. Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you.